So, how did you first get into writing fantasy?
Probably came from reading fantasy from an early age. From right at the beginning, I was reading Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and David Eddings and Terry Brooks. And over the years of reading so much fantasy, at some point, I think as a child, I started scribbling down my own stories. And over the years, I just kept doing more and more stories until eventually I wrote my first novel when I was 19. And I was convinced it was going to be a bestseller. So clearly, I thought I'll write the sequel. And nobody has ever seen those novels and never will because they're terrible.
Do you still have them though?
Probably somewhere on a really old disc somewhere. If I search through my archives, it might be there. But I don't think anybody wants to see them. What about yourself? How did you get into fantasy and then writing fantasy?
I was also reading it from a very young age. Some of the same authors you mentioned. Also, I really liked Lloyd Alexander, Robin McKinley. They were some of my favorites. I read a little Anne McCaffrey when I was really too young to get everything that was going on in it, which that was fine though. There were dragons. I was happy. And in fact, and I hesitate to use the term fantasy novel, I tried to write was when I was 10 years old, and it really was essentially an Anne McCaffrey fanfic and without any of the romantic bits. And that's well buried in a bin somewhere. And since then, I've written some slightly less terrible novels sequentially through my entire life. I went through a phase where everybody, my main characters, were terrible Mary Sue characters who had to be the most powerful mage and the best sword fighter and royalty and this and that. And hopefully now I've moved beyond that and writing something that's a little bit less self-indulgent.
So, who was the first author for you that not necessarily the first one that you read, but the first kind of gateway author that made you realize fantasy could be a whole spectrum of different things? Because to begin with, I was reading a lot of kind of really sword and sorcery quest type books, and it wasn't until I came to someone like David Gemmell in my early teens that I realized, oh, wait, fantasy could be one of a thousand different things.
It's a great question. Let me think. Boy, one of the first ones. I know I read, I got really enamored of Stephen Brust when I was a teenager, and part of that was because it had a bit of a sci-fi feel to it as well, and it was, and they weren't remotely quest fantasy sword and sorcery, go defeat the Dark Lord and, get the magical orb or whatever. It was more, crime novels, really, and, just in a fantasy setting. And that was what's one of the things that sort of opened up my mind to the idea that there were other plot lines and other structures and other types of characters besides that, like, you're a farm boy, you have a destiny, you go do the thing, everything's great. There's a big battle where a city's besieged and there's magical explosions and it all ends happily ever after.
Yeah, I read a lot of those growing up. A lot of them.
I thought the big besieged city was obligatory, in fact, for ages. Like I would start writing a book and I'd be like, ah, oh, I need to fit a big siege in here somewhere because it's just there always was one.
Yeah, I've done it once and now I've got it out of my system. I'm not sure I want to do it again, so.
Everybody's got to do it once.
Yeah.
What first inspired you to write? I know Mageborn is a second series, a sequel series.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, what inspired you to originally write Battlemage, right? That's the first one.
Yeah.
And then I'm curious if your source of inspiration, how it was different for starting off this second series.
So originally writing Battlemage came from an idea. I'd written a short story as a sort of homage to one of my favorite authors who'd sort of passed away. And I wrote the short story about an old wizard on his last adventure. He comes out retirement for one final quest with his old friend. And I sort of wrote it for myself. I've never shown it to anybody. And I just sort of saved it on the computer and that was it and forgot about it. But then over time, I was working on something else. But I kept thinking back to this character and thinking, well, what did he do as a young man? And what did he get up to? And what were his adventures? And so he became the main character of the first trilogy, really, Balfourus, who's this middle-aged guy. So he's not a young guy when the books start. He feels the sun on the back of his head slightly because he's gone a little bit bald, and he's got a bit of white in his beard, and he's now kind of closer to my own age. So, although I don't feel the sun on the back of my head, but, you know, there's white in my hair, that's for sure. So he was the starting point, and then, so I wrote the first trilogy. I did something different with each book. I wanted to kind of break the mold of a standard trilogy and not have it as one large story and do different genres. Like we talked about, you know, you could be a crime novel or a horror novel or a war novel all within fantasy. So I did that for my first trilogy. And this time around with Mageborn, I've done it more traditional in that it's one huge story cut into three pieces. But it was always a case of, so what happens next after the end of the events of Chaos Mage, which is the third book in the first trilogy? What happens next, and where do we go, and who's around, and who's new, and who's coming back from the shadows, and that kind of thing.
Fantastic. And that that actually, you know, one of the things I'm most curious about is how you picked the points of view for the book, because you know, you have this story in Mageborn that it's one story and one thread going from the beginning to the end, but we see it from a lot of different points of view, and nobody has the complete picture. And I'm, you know, you could have picked so many different viewpoints to show it unfold, and I'm curious about how you decided which characters you were going to focus on.
Yeah, that's a good question. There are a couple of characters from the first trilogy that I just felt that their stories were really not done. I just felt that I'd begun to scratch the surface of them. So one of them was Munro, who from the first trilogy, she sort of has an adventure, but then it's she kind of rides off into the sunset, but that wasn't the end for her. I knew there had to be more. And another character called Tammy, who appears in and out of the first trilogy, and then she's in the third book, and I'd wanted to see her grow and develop. And while I brought back some of the other characters like Balfourus and so on, they were never going to be the main focus for this second trilogy. So like the kind of the Star Wars thing, I'd wanted to bring in a new generation of younger points of view who don't have all of the baggage or the weight or the story, as it were, from the first trilogy. So you've got this blending of old and new. So there's rewards there for the long-term readers, but equally, if you've not read the first trilogy, you can pick it up and hopefully get a complete story.
I liked all of them. I loved Munro. Fun. And I also really particularly appreciated, as someone who is a mom myself, that she has a husband and she has she has a kid, but that's not the end of her story, that she does go out and have adventures and it doesn't slow her down in the slightest. You know, I think that you see a lot in fantasy, especially with female characters, of, oh, and then they get married, they live happily ever after, the end, nothing interesting ever happens after that point. And as someone who has been married and have children, I appreciate that the adventure does not stop there.
Absolutely, yes. There's a lot of characters in there that are up to different stages of their life, men and women, and I wanted to reflect that. You've got the younger characters, who the younger mages kind of just starting out, but then you've got people who are a bit further down the road, like Munro, as you say, who has had the training, and it's like, right, she's not done just because she's married and got a son. It's like she still wants to go out and have adventures and get involved in things.
Absolutely.
So, look, moving to the Tethered Mage, what was the starting point for you building this world? Where did the sort of seeds of the ideas come from?
Well, it actually started when I was on a really long car drive with my husband. We were coming back from a wedding that was 6 hours away, and he's a video game designer, so our car conversations are incredibly geeky. And we were talking about some world building stuff, and he was talking about, obviously, one thing that we have in both of our fantasy books and that shows up in a lot of fantasy books is the idea that just semi-random people are just born with magic, and that it can be very powerful to the point where it's potentially going to have an effect on the world. And he said just, yeah, if that happened, those people would be in control. There's no other way that would pan out. And of course, I have a contrary imagination, and I started thinking, well, that's not true. There's lots of other ways that it could turn out. you know, and I started thinking about different ways, different societies that might arise if you had that, and I came up with the idea of falcons and falconers, which is in my book. Just for people who haven't read it, there's an empire in which they have the laws require that everyone who is born with a certain level of magical power is linked to a falconer who can seal and unseal their power to. Just as an attempt of the empire to control it. And I came up with that idea. And the minute I thought of that, I started just really being like, ooh, well, that would be a really difficult relationship to have. And then I got the idea for my two main characters and their relationship. And then the story just kind of took off from there.
Because there's this strange symbiosis between the two characters and Falcon and Falconer in general. And we see, I like the fact that we see different versions of that. Like the main character... And her mage are, I don't want to say out of sync, but they don't really get on to begin with. But equally, we see another pairing who have found a way to cope with it. But that's taken years and time and progress, and their relationship is very different.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to show different... I wanted to show a relationship that had been built up over time and that was working to sort of contrast with this initially... dysfunctional relationship that we have between Amalia and Zyra. Because, I mean, clearly it has to be possible to make a working relationship for this system to have endured for hundreds of years. Otherwise, it would have fallen apart a long time ago.
But equally, it's also not the only way to deal with it. Because, as you said, there are other countries who use magic in a very different way.
Yes, yes. I have the other, the sort of rival in power to the Empire is Vaskandar, which is a country to the north in which the mages are in control and, in fact, ruled by these witch lords, which I go into a lot in book two, which I'm working on right now. And that's a place where the people without magic are oppressed. It's almost kind of a reverse situation. And there's certainly many other options as well. I know in yours, it's. I thought it was interesting that at the beginning of Mageborn, obviously there's. I don't want to be spoilery, but obviously there's some changes in how mages are perceived that happen throughout the story for various reasons. Yeah. But at the beginning, one thing I really liked was that you have all these different countries with different views on mages and how to deal with them. And some have very negative views and some have, you know, more mixed or even positive views. And it's all influenced by their recent history. But, you know, some of them are just whatever. We don't really care about them either way. We just want them out of our country. Some people just want to drown them in the river. And I was actually really curious about how, when you were doing your world building, did you start with ideas for the countries and then come up with their attitudes towards mages from that? Or did you build it together? How did you deal with this widespread of ways that they developed of having the different attitudes that they have towards mages?
I started with the different countries and the different cultures, and from that arose how they would deal with magic. So there's one country called Drazia, who are a kind of matriarchal society in a way, where all of the men become warriors and all of the women run the businesses and run the networks and all the merchants and stuff. And so in their society, magic has absolutely no place. They wouldn't know what to do with it. They're not afraid of it. They have complete indifference. So if a child is born with magic, they just send it away and just say, well, you know, on you go. Good luck to you, but, you know, we can't deal with you here, because their society is built upon skill that takes many years, and they see magic as this sort of awful shortcut. And then there are other countries where historically magic has caused problems with a war that's hinted at, so obviously that country is very against magic. So it completely arose partly from when I originally built the different nationalities, and then partly from the sort of more recent history from the first trilogy.
I love that richness that was layered in. You know, I'm sure it's great to have three books to build up your world and then get to start a fresh story in it with all that work already done.
It is, but I also have to go back and keep looking at my own books to go, wait, was it this? Oh, yes, it's that one. And okay, put it back on the shelf, which is always handy.
Yeah, I'm just now starting to run into that with the writing book two, realizing, uh-oh, I can't go against anything that's in book one because it's been printed. sort of a startling realization.
Yeah, once it's locked in print, that's it.
Yeah.
You can't go back and re-edit.
Yep. Can't move that city 5 miles to the west because it's more convenient there.
So I want to talk a bit about the magic in your books, because they're we talked about the kind of symbiosis, but also you've got very different types of mages. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the sort of skills and different abilities?
Sure. There's, let me see, I think four main types of magic. There's alchemy, which is just mixing potions and substances that have magical properties. But you still have to have the innate ability in order to sort of connect the magic that makes it work. And for alchemy, the power is drawn from inherent properties of the substances themselves. You have warlocks, fire warlocks or storm warlocks. Zyra, one of the main characters, is a fire warlock. They have, their power comes from within, and it's very deadly and dangerous and difficult to control, and can be completely devastating in battle, to the point where there's very, very few of them, because most of them don't even survive long enough to make it to a place where they could be safe or get scooped up by the Empire. And then there's artifice. Artificers, basically, their magic, there's two different main forms their magic takes, but both are centered on patterns. They can either do like runic circles and diagrams and things when they want to sort of do something like a seal or a barrier or something where they're essentially taking an object that's already there and sort of dictating a new rule for it. Mm-hmm. Or they can also do wirework artifice, where they're taking, they're sort of using twisted wire and beads on the wire to almost like a circuit board to channel magical power and create a little decision tree, so they can create very complex rules for a spell. And they're always enchanting objects or putting a ward on a wall or something that's already there. And then there's vivimancers, who work with the power of life, and they're controlling plants or animals, usually. Although there's one character in the book who can use his power on humans, which is considered creepy by other vivimancers. And I hope the readers.
Very creepy. Yeah, it's very unsettling. So did it take you a long time to develop this system, or was it something that grew organically?
Well, you know, it started, I knew I wanted a fire warlock, and then I also knew I wanted other kinds of magic because I wanted warlocks to be rare, and I had this whole system in place, you know, so I needed to have other kinds of mages. And at first I was just throwing off offhand references of like, oh yeah, this person's an alchemist, and then... Then I had to figure out, well, what is that? You know, and I put a lot more work into it as different levels of drafting went. The idea for artifice originally started out as two different types of magic, one being the one where they were doing the diagrams and stuff, and the other being the wirework and the beads. But then I realized that they were really functionally doing the same thing in the same ways, just with a different medium. One is like drawing and one is like sculpture, but they're both art essentially. Mm. And they were all following the same rules, so I just combined them to make things a little simpler. But the artifice was kind of inspired by a friend of mine she makes jewelry, and she's also a computer programmer, not a computer program, that would be very different. She's an AI. And she makes this wirework and bead jewelry, and I sort of conflated that with her being a programmer in my head, and came up with the idea of like, ooh, what if you could make it almost like a circuit board, so that you're making these beautiful pieces of jewelry that are actually containing this information and commands that are magically enhanced to create effects.
Yeah, and you have a character in the book who we see creating some interesting things, and their approach is very unique and different to the other people's view of magic and what you can do with it.
Oh yeah, Estrella.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's one of my favorite characters. She's kind of a teenage mad scientist artificer, and she was a lot of fun to write.
was she the most fun to write? Most fun character?
Very possibly. I mean, there are a few who are favorites to write. Of my favorite characters to write, she was the easiest. I also had a lot of fun writing La Contessa, Amalia's mom, but she's very hard to write because she's just supposed to be very brilliant, and everything she says has to like have a little edge to it and be really witty and clever. And like, I don't talk that way myself, so I would, you know, I had to have the I type out the dialogue, and you know when you have a conversation and then 3 days later you think of the cutting thing that you should have said. But But since I'm a writer, I could go back and edit that in and be like, oh, so she's like what we could all be if we got to go back in time and change to say all the most witty possible things we could have said in the moment.
Yeah, she's a very layered character, I would say.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun writing her relationship with Amalia. Their mother-daughter relationship is complicated. I've seen a lot of domineering moms who are just kind of evil. And as a domineering mom, you know, I feel like we also love our children. There's more to it than just being bossy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a character in Mageborn who's got a very kind of bossy mother, Ren, and her mum. And they don't get on because her mum had a very clear vision of what her child was going to do and what she was going to be, and she blew that out of the water by being born with magic, which her mum takes as a terrible insult to all of her plans that she'd had set up for her since birth, and a great inconvenience. And so it's fun to write those kind of complex characters.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Ren's evolution. You know, she's such a great character when she shows up at the Red Tower at the Mage School, and she's got these very sort of set defined ideas of what the world is like and what her place is in it, and it gives her this great confidence at first that she knows what she's going to do, this is going to be fine, and then all of those assumptions are challenged. But I love that even when her assumptions are being challenged and she's having these big crises, she's still so practical. Like, she doesn't, you know, she's not like crying in a corner, bewailing her fate or anything. She's just sort of treating it practically, even when she's at her most confused and her most emotionally unsettled. And that's, I really liked her.
It took me a long time to write the conversations between her and another character called Garvey, who's this belligerent, incredibly intelligent and layered character. This is the sort of thing I'd write his dialogue, go away and come back 3 days later and go, oh, yeah, that's what he should have said. And I can just keep reworking it.
Was Garvey from book one, or is he new for, from the previous series, or is he new for Mageborn?
He's completely new for Mageborn, yeah.
Cool. I'm very curious. Having read the whole book, I'm really curious to see more about him. And his relationship with Ren is really interesting. It's one of the things I'm most curious to see evolve in book two. Yes. I can't say.
Yeah, we can't spoil it. We're trying to avoid spoilers as much as possible. Yeah. Which is tricky, but you know, we're doing it. We're doing it.
It's a very interesting relationship.
Yes.
Yeah, and actually, speaking of interesting characters that you have in Mageborn, I know one really interesting choice that you made was to start out, or at least unless this has changed since the version I read, but that you start out in the first chapter with an antagonist point of view, and that you continue to have some chapters that are from antagonist points of view throughout the story. And those are very intriguing chapters, because while there are things it lets us see and understand, there are also a lot of things that are not revealed and that I'm dreadfully curious about. Those were some of the most interesting. I mean, you had a lot of interesting chapters in the book, but those were some of the most interesting. And I'm curious what gave you the idea to have that antagonist perspective and to start with it and sustain it through the book like that.
Yes, it's not really a spoiler to say the first chapter contains a character called Akosh, and it was her point of view. I've seen too many books in the past where they have the villain or the protagonist, and you never actually see anything from their point of view. They're just labeled as evil or mad, and to actually see how they view the world, because they don't view themselves as villains, they view themselves as just trying to do something completely different or have a very different view from someone else. And so I wanted that contrast. Now, she has very specific goals, and they're obviously different to other people, but I wanted to see her evolution throughout the book and the series as well, so it wasn't completely a one-sided story, as it were.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, and also it created a situation where sometimes there were some things as a reader we had more information about than any given character in the book, because we were seeing both sides of the story. But on the other hand, there's still some things that the characters know that we don't know. And even that, you know, those scenes that are from Akasha's perspective, things that she knows, even though we're from her point of view, that we don't know. And she'll have some little plot that hints at it. And I'm like, oh, tell me more, you know, but you're good. You don't, you don't reveal too much. So it was just really an interesting perspective to have. Yeah. So I thought that really definitely added a lot to the story.
Thank you. It's that drip feeding of information and trying to balance plot with the story and pace and keep it all moving without just overloading people with too much exposition. That's always a delicate balancing act, I find. What about yourself?
Yes, it is a real challenge. I have a lot of notes. I'll have like 50 pages of notes, you know, and when I'm revealing information is one of the things that I'll frequently track in the notes. And then, you know, I'll have it all plotted out for the order things will be revealed and how they'll be revealed. And then I go, no. And I switch it around, or change something from being a dun 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 dramatic reveal to something that the characters go and find out themselves in a way that is less of an info bomb being dropped, or whatever, but more of a hands-on experience, or vice versa. Yeah, so it's almost a whole another access of story building. It's just when we find out what, and I know having multiple points of view must add an extra dimension to that whole planning, where it's not only when do the readers find it out, but whose perspective are they going to find it out from, and when do each of the characters learn this? I mean, there are points in your book where we can see something happen, and then later we'll see people learn about it in different ways, and it have different effects as the news kind of trickles out into the world. I thought that was with time delays built in everything. And did you have to like plot out, okay, well, it's going to take this amount of days for this news to reach this town?
It took a lot of fiddling, that's for sure. I had to occasionally I'd start writing a chapter and think, would they have found out by now? And go back and track it and think, right, how many days is this chapter set after that one? And oh, yeah, they would have heard. Okay, let's put something in there. So there's that. Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated with lots of points of view and the story setting different locations as well. So,
yeah,
I think I worked a lot more on juggling some of those kind of key moments in this book than I have on the previous ones. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really the control of information is kind of an important both theme and also an avenue of causing an effect for characters in the book without getting too spoilery. Mm-hmm. So. Extra important to get it right, I guess.
So do you have like a whole other book of a world Bible of information that you have to find ways to trickle pieces in as you go along?
If I were really smart, I would keep a big informational world Bible. That would be a great thing to do. But I tend to have my notes are more, you know, I'll have a big file of disorganized notes that I just will throw something in a random location when an idea occurs to me. And then I pull those out and distill them into something more organized when it comes time to write a draft or make an outline or do revisions. And I'll just kind of keep pulling things out and organizing them in successively more organized documents like nesting dolls. Like, in the weird way.
So did you go through a lot of drafts then with this first book, if you were constantly doing that?
Well, The Tethered Mage had an interesting drafting process in that I started to write a draft, got about maybe 15,000, 20,000 words in, and then said, all right, wait a minute. Nope. This is great. Now I know where I'm going. I'm going to start over from scratch. And I started over from scratch. And that was coming along great. And then I wanted to enter it. I had a complete draft and I was doing some revisions to try and, you know, but it was a messy draft. I was doing some revisions to try and get it into good shape. And there was a contest that I wanted to enter, Pitch Wars, which is this fantastic online contest. And so I entered it, but I hadn't finished my revisions. And I thought I had 2 weeks and it was going to be fine. But then I started getting requests right away for it. And I hadn't finished revisions and I had to finish them very fast in about 2 days for this draft. And then I wound up getting an offer from an agent before going through the contest, and then I did a lot of revisions with her. But it wound up the initial draft wound up being much more rushed than it usually is for me because of the drive to make it into this contest. And then when I got the offer from Orbit, it was originally a young adult novel. It was 75,000 words long, and they said, "This is fantastic, but can you make it adult fantasy instead of young adult, and can you add 50,000 words, but keep it pacing?"
Wow.
So add 50,000 words, but keep your fast pacing. And I was like, okay, Yeah, sure, I can definitely do that. 2 months, you say. Very well. So that was terrifying.
No pressure.
Yeah. But, you know, and I had to, I had really, by that point, I'd woven my plot so tight. And then I had to come up with this 50,000 words of additional plot and weave it into this tightly plotted story without, in a seamless fashion. That was really not easy, but I'm happy with how it came out.
Good. Well, it got there in the end, and it got you the book deal. So that's the important thing.
Yeah.
So Mageborn, the first book in the Age of Dread, has been published. It was published on the 4th of October and is available from all good bookshops. And the first trilogy, The Age of Darkness, is still currently available, which starts with Battle Mage, Blood Mage, and then Chaos Mage.
Great. And The Tethered Mage is coming out on October 24th. And the sequel, The Defiant Heir, is in progress and coming out eventually. and it's The Tethered Mage is book one in the Swords and Fire trilogy.